Hello, this is Vincent Purita. Today's date is January 19th of 2018, and I am here today with Phil Ball in his home. We're conducting an interview about some important historical things that Phil has been witness to. So, hoping to hear a lot of great stuff on this. How are you today, Phil?
Fine, thank you.
So, first thing that I would like to go back and talk about would be the atomic bomb. What was that? Fat Man and Little Boy dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I know you had mentioned before that briefly you were in the Army towards the end of World War II. That is correct, right?
Yeah, I was one of the last draftees from Jersey City. In 1946, the war was over, the draft was just winding down, and I was a student at NYU at that time, and then was called up and drafted into the Army.
So do you remember where you were when you had heard about the bomb?
Well, the bomb went off in 1945, and what I remember was not a concern of horror or concern about the extent of devastation, the amount of people killed, but rather, and this sounds cruel and heartless now, but rather a sense of kind of happiness and joy that Harry Truman, the president, had the courage to order the detonating of the bomb, which really brought the war to an end and saved American lives, because I grew up in World War II, and I was still a kid when the fighting was really severe. But I remember at least one person from my neighborhood who lost an arm, I think, in one of the South Pacific battles. I knew him quite well. A man named Al Huff. He came back with one arm missing, and when the bomb went off, I thought to myself, gee, this is good. This is going to save so many American lives. We won't have to fight and invade Japan and do all that hand-to-hand fighting. So today that kind of response, I'm sure, sounds heartless.
Now, for when they had announced this, like, did they show any of the effects? Like, did you go, oh my God, after you had seen the devastation, or that wasn't widely released at the time?
No. I think the announcement, the journalism, the publicity to the public was one of kind of triumph and this was a good wartime, a good military move. I remember then, particularly in World War II, and particularly because for some part of the war, I grew up in a candy store, so we always had a lot of newspapers in front of us. You know, a newspaper stand, I always had to arrange papers and look at them, and I remember how when anything eventful happened, the newspaper used big block headlines, type that was perhaps 2 inches in height, the typeface, and the bomb was that kind of thing. It was a dramatic, triumphant type announcement. I don't think the inhumanity, the magnitude of nuclear war, was at all on anybody's consciousness. Einstein and the physicists went to Roosevelt, said we could do this. I know some of the physicists had concerns about what they were bringing into humanity, what they were giving birth to. I've read that, and I know a little about the history of some of the nuclear scientists, like Oppenheimer. Of course, I worked with some of those. One of my clients was involved in the Manhattan Project, and I heard firsthand some of the emotional attitudes about the nuclear scientists. But Einstein came to Roosevelt with a group of nuclear physicists, and of course Einstein was concerned about getting back at the Nazis who forced all those people out of Europe. But I think they had a sense of being a part of a winning wartime strategy, and Roosevelt welcomed that. And I think it was Truman who had to make the momentous decision, but I'm not sure Truman even appreciated the magnitude of what he was doing. His view was, hey, he's gonna authorize a dropping of a devastating explosive, which will save American lives. And I think that was a preponderance response of Americans, and I think they welcomed that news with joy. This was a good thing for America. So the horror upon humanity was just not in anybody's consciousness at that time, in my opinion.
Do you remember if you had ever heard of a big push maybe to utilize the bomb in the European theater against the Germans?
No, I don't think that ever came about. And I think that could be answered objectively because we know time-wise the development of the bomb in the Manhattan Project and the various in Tennessee, the General Grove. There's all types of biographical material which would give you a timeline. And I suspect when Germany, when they were near collapse, the bomb was not quite ready yet. You know, there was a good deal of testing. So this is all conjecture on my part. That's an interesting question, but a military historian could easily answer that objectively. Was the United States ready to drop the bomb in terms of development? So I couldn't answer that question objectively, but my hunch is we were not ready for it. That question should be researched and pursued, though.
Let's move on to another big historical thing, the assassination of JFK. Do you remember where you were when that had happened?
Oh, vividly. I was working for Merrill Lynch at that time, and I was in the branch office in Paramus, New Jersey, and I walked up to the teletype machine. We had a teletype machine that would click out news minute by minute, all stockbrokers. That was very important in terms of the stock market. So you'd walk up to the machine and you'd see 105, this happened, 108, this happened. And I looked at the machine and a report, the president has been shot in Dallas. And then we all turned on the radio and we just were kind of paralyzed listening. I think Walter Cronkite came on and then said, it's been official, the president is dead. So that, yeah, very vividly. I even more vividly, I was watching TV when the assassin,
Lee Harvey Oswald,
I was watching TV because his killing was broadcast on television. When the man who owned the nightclub walked up to him and pulled the trigger, and then you saw the expression on Oswald's face as the pain reached him. So those events were right. You were just an immediate witness to them.
Yeah, that was, what was that, Jack Ruby, I think?
Yeah, Jack Ruby killed Oswald. That's correct. And what his motive, then you get all kinds of conspiratorial theories. How that came about, I don't know. But the assassination of Kennedy was the beginning of a feeling of revulsion, because we subsequently had the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. Then we had the assassination of Martin Luther King, and there was this sinking feeling how these our leaders, who really were admired and revered, at least from my point of view, how those assassinations could continue to take place. And I just continually had a feeling of regret about that, and regret for the country that this was happening to us. I really think it was a very corroding influence in our civilized veneer.
Now, when this had happened too, did you know that it was just Lee Harvey Oswald and not a foreign power?
Yeah, I really never speculated about those things. I would read that stuff, conspiratorial paper and things in the newspaper. I tended to dismiss it, You know, the Warren Commission was convened, and I think the consensus of that commission was that it was not conspiratorial. It was the work of one man. Because I've always done a lot of community work, I was rather friendly with a physician who lived in Englewood, John Latimer. John Latimer was a urologist, very famous urologist. He was president of the International Urological Society, practiced at Columbia Presbyterian. John was a historian as well as a physician. He was an expert on Lincoln. He collected memorabilia of Lincoln, of Washington, and he was an expert on the similarity, wrote a book on a similarity between Lincoln and Kennedy. There are a number of coincidental things about both of them. And he went down to the warehouse, in Dallas. He bought a rifle from Japan, the exact model that Harvey Oswald used. He went up to the same floor, to the same window, and recreated the shot. And I think he proved that, to his own satisfaction, that Lee Harvey Oswald had been alone and had fired the shot, and there was no other shots fired, which was contended. So that kind of brought me face to face with some degree of verification, but I had always in my mind accepted that this was not a conspiratorial thing.
What was the mood like of the nation after all of that had happened? Was there fear? Was there solidarity or anything like that?
Are you talking about Kennedy?
Yes.
The Kennedy assassination? No, I think people were just appalled. And there was this feeling, great sadness. You know, Kennedy was such a romantic figure who I think had appeal for an awful lot. And he had the figure of the young widow with the little children near her at the time of the funeral. And then the funeral itself brought such a feeling of mourning to the nation. That whole weekend of the funeral, I know I was a stockbroker then. We closed down. The market closed down around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I think the assassination was shortly after noon in Dallas. We closed down. We didn't open till Tuesday, which happens in a stock market when there's a national catastrophe. But usually we open the next day. Well, you had the weekend, then couldn't open Monday. They opened Tuesday. But during that whole period, it's as if someone in your own family died. There was kind of a period of mourning in the country. Very dramatic, very intense. Really, you could feel it all over. I think there was almost a kind of a lethargy. People went into a kind of a depression, really. That was a terrible event.
Hopefully on to something a little bit more heartwarming, or at least a sense of pride for America, but the landing on the moon. Where were you when that had happened?
Watching on TV, a gathering with my family. Our kids were young then, and we were just in our living room watching it on TV with a total sense of wonderment, disbelief, amazing that this could be done. Really a sense that disbelief that it wouldn't happen, you know, that, but such a great achievement. It's one of the really significant, exciting events in the history of the world that I witnessed, that I still get a feeling of excitement and joy right now when I think about it. It's such a marvelous, marvelous achievement on the part of mankind.
Hmm.
Yeah, and that, you know, the beginning someday, hundreds of years from now, that'll be, I think, fairly routine. But that's when it started. An amazing advance.
Did you ever sort of dream or speculate in that moment, like, you know, in 50 years we'll be living on the moon or something like that?
No, I've always thought that's inevitable. The one thing that impressed me, my wife and I, about 3 years ago, were invited down to North Carolina for a wedding, and we went to the Kitty Hawk Museum, which is a national park, wonderful place to visit. And there you see the beginning of flight in 1900 or 1903, where the Wright brothers took off. And the extraordinary advance within 60 years to go from the Wright brothers to the moon is just a remarkable achievement in science and engineering. And it's almost unparalleled. Maybe you've had comparable advances in medicine. I'm not sure, but the speed of development within the aircraft or that industry is just very impressive.
On to another big topic, the creation of Israel. When you were born, it did not exist. And then after World War II, it did exist. Just initial thoughts, feelings?
Once again, I witnessed that being a stockbroker in the Merrill Lynch office, where news kept coming through on an ongoing basis. I have a very interesting emotional experience as a Jew. I have never really been very close to intense emotional reactions as a Jew. I grew up in a very mixed neighborhood in Jersey City. We were the only Jewish family. There was a high degree of anti-Semitism, and that kind of stifled any sense of pride in myself as being a Jew. I had never had that. And when Israel came into being, I was pleased that Truman cast the deciding vote at the urging of his former business partner in the haberdashery store, I think a man named Harry Jacobs. And I thought that was a good thing that Israel achieved that. I thought they deserved it, but there was no sense of elation on my part. I remember, too, the early war, the Six-Day War, the war that really enabled them to survive. Nixon, Golda Meir, went to Nixon asking for help. Nixon sent some military assistance. And I was pleased that they won that war. I had a sense of inevitably they would win. I've always felt that Jewish tragic events would be reversed and would come out with a positive thing. But I had no sense of elation about that. I did have a sense of justification that good guys won what they deserved. But, you know, that's offset now. I have a lot of very mixed feelings about some of the current Israeli political action. It doesn't jibe with my philosophy. On the other hand, I am involved in Jewish theology. I have deep convictions about being Jewish, and I think the whole issue of Zionism is justified, and I'm horrified by the Holocaust. I can identify one blood member in my family who died in the Holocaust. But while I thought that the Israel coming about was a good thing and an important thing, and I was terribly unhappy about the inability of Holocaust victims to reach Palestine at the end of World War II when the English kept them out, the events like the Exodus, the events on the ship, or the ship, the St. Louis, that was turned away from Cuba and turned away from the United States, and I think some of those people went back to Europe and perished. Those things upset me a great deal. But I did not have a personal feeling of great rapture and joy when Israel came about. I think I just had a feeling of satisfaction, and what happened was right and justified.
So what do you feel the future of Israel should be?
Well, I feel it should truly be a democratic nation. I think everybody in Israel has a right to exercise the type of constitutional privileges that we have here in America. I think America politically is an ideal. The America, independent of what Trump has brought, is a model for Israel and much of the world. And I really am very apprehensive about Israel being an theocratic state with an autocratic orthodox ruling class that is doing things that are really wrong. I'm now a Reform Jew, and the Reform Jews in Israel are really oppressed. And I think that Israel is on a path right now under Netanyahu, which can lead to nothing. But really, they're on the verge of being accused of being an apartheid state, and I think much of that is coming about because of their own narrow practices. But you've had a whole element there of immigrant, particularly I think from the Ashkenazi community, that come in for commercial reasons and exploitation, materialistic reasons, which are an anathema to my own philosophy of egalitarianism. So I have a good deal of concern about Israel. Irma's family is there now. I really like the country. I really enjoy being there. It's a marvelous place of history and antiquity, and I've made 13 trips there, and I have great admiration for much of the country. They're a wonderful culture of art, and they have a wonderful kind of humanity about them, and that's true of the Jewish culture. That's why it's a wonderful culture to live by. But we have that in human nature. You always have good offset by bad, and I have a good deal of negative feelings about some of the current political behavior.
Getting back to America, you saw the rise of the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and all of that. Can you tell me a little bit about how things changed during the civil rights movement?
Well, I don't know about change. I remember early on in Englewood, I was very active in PTA. And I became chairman of the city PTA council in Englewood. We had a very active parents group of men and women with kids in the public school system. And I had a meeting the night that King was assassinated. I had a meeting with the superintendent of schools and a PTA parent who worked closely with me, a man named Harvey Sherman, who was a terrific guy. And Harvey was a senior executive at the Port Authority. And I met with him and the superintendent of schools. The three of us had dinner together at the Clinton Inn. And we were talking with the superintendent about the schools and their problems and what his agenda was. And while we were having dinner, the news came in that King had been assassinated. And I just thought to myself, the same way I remember when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, I had this feeling of depression and sadness for America that this could happen and how devastating it would be for the country. I remember when Kennedy was assassinated, I heard about it about 8 o'clock in the morning. I was outside. We lived on Hudson Avenue in Englewood, and I was raking some leaves or cleaning up in the backyard, and I heard the news about Kennedy. And the same thing, I had this great feeling that these wonderful people could be assassinated by people who I had such a feeling of scorn and distaste for the assassins, the people who pulled the trigger. And I was just terribly sad. And then, of course, you know, the riots started, the riots in Detroit, the Newark riots, and I just thought that there was this inevitable split. I come out of World War II, and when we moved to Englewood, we had this, the young liberals in Englewood, and I was kind of a part of that, talking about reconciliation, getting rid of prejudice, breaking down discrimination in housing, in schools. And I thought we were making such great progress. And I think that the assassination of King started a whole counter movement against stuff that was so good under Johnson, the civil rights legislation that went in. And it started a period of hate and separation in America again, which was just so reactionary. And I think to this day we're still fighting that same problem, much as cosmetically we have desegregation in our society. But I think racism is alive and well in our country today.
Now, you were talking about the Englewood school systems during this time. Were they integrated during this time?
The Englewood school system and Dwight Morrow, I've been deeply involved in that system, and even today I'm still involved in it. At one point, Dwight Morrow was an elite high school. By the way, the campus is beautiful. The buildings are beautiful. It was the architect for the Dwight Morrow campus was in one of the he did some work at Princeton. The school was an elite school. It was a receiving district for a very wide geographical area. Students came from Oradell on the north and northwest to Cliffside Park. And you had, for example, I think it was Raleigh Chereau, one of the astronauts, went to Dwight Morrow. It was just an elite high school. By the time, and my kids went through the system from kindergarten right through graduation at high school. Mm-hmm. By the time my kids started, particularly Bobby in the first grade, Englewood was sued by the state of New Jersey for segregated schools. Liberal parents picketed Cleveland School, where Bobby was in attendance in the first grade or kindergarten, and he was one of the kids who either was shut out because of the picketing. But at that point, the school system, really the education here was quite good. By the time Bobby, our oldest son, reached a high school, you could see the decline of education in Dwight Morrow. They cut out the honors program. I think they cut out some of the AP courses, or they cut them year by year. There was budget cut. There was just this winding down, and of course, then you start getting white flight, and you start getting an influx. The whites left. The school became a minority school and turned out to be totally African-American. Now, of course, it's gotten some diversification. There's been an influx of Spanish, the Hispanic population, and there are some white people coming back into it, and I'm now part of the activity trying to work on renaissance, rejuvenation, and I think that can be done, but it can be done by bringing in for example, the state of New Jersey did put a satellite of the Bergen Academy in there. It's a separated thing on the campus was not integrated, but there is an academic component there now, not up to the level of Hackensack, but there is a good academic component there. So we've got a lot of reasons why we may ultimately turn that system around. But my history there was one for decades of just watching it in the state of decline. And of course, I was involved. I was on the council in Englewood when we had an appointed school board here. The president of the council was chairman of the board of school estimate or the school budget. I served as president of the council. So for a semester, I was in charge of the school budget. I got to know the problems very deeply, and the problems were very, very deep. So there was a big period of decline, and now I'm hoping to be a part of the period of rejuvenation.
Besides the Newark riots and stuff, during the time of civil rights and integration, did you see a big upheaval in the state, or was it business as usual and people were just like, yeah, there are black people here now, whatever?
Well, the Newark riots had great impact on me. My grandfather, Lewis Ball, when he came to America in the late 1800s, bought a piece of property and opened a butcher shop on Boyd Street in Newark. Now, Boyd Street was a Jewish ghetto at that point, like the Lower East Side. But and Boyd Street, Prince Street, there were push carts, a total duplication of the East Side. When the Newark riots came along, Boyd Street and that Jewish ghetto area at that, by that point, when riots came along in the, what was it, the 70s, I guess, the late 60s, early 70s, the Jews had all left. They had migrated to Essex County and Bergen County. But the riots destroyed the area that my grandfather's butcher shop was in. And I grew up, I lived in Newark from age, I was born in Newark and lived there until age 7, until my parents moved out when my father went bankrupt. So I, as a kid, I used to go down to Prince Street and Boyd Street, visit my grandfather, and my parents would get down there to the shop. They went to a bakery there, Wiegler's Bakery. I knew that area intimately, and I was very distressed by the Newark riots. Not only because of what it did to places that I knew intimately and was familiar with, but the fact that we had troops and National Guard firing on American citizens, and to see that kind of civil unrest in our country was very upsetting for me, much more upsetting than some of the things you've talked about, Hiroshima, and World War II. The Newark riots were much more personal for me.
Yeah, that close to home personalness, probably that's like when you know and understand these things.
Yeah.
I'm very certain it had that big impact.
Yeah.
Next up on the list, the War of Vietnam. That was one of the most unpopular wars in the United States, definitely. How did you feel about it during the time period?
I think I was just disgusted by it. I was disgusted by the attitude of the people who didn't want to go, although, you know, my older son was one of them. He got an exemption because he had a bad knee and he was in college. But I was really unhappy at the lack of patriotism, because I was a part of World War II when we were all very patriotic and love of country, and I wanted to go in the Army. Thank God I went in after the war. So I was unhappy with the opponents of Vietnam. On the other hand, I was disgusted with America being in Vietnam, It's only now that I'm really unhappy that I know about things like the Pentagon Papers and with Merrill Lynch and Bank of America. I was recently a part of a more intimate expression of the making of the documentary by Ken Burns on Vietnam. You see some of these terrible things that our leadership did, lying and deceiving. So Vietnam is just a very unhappy experience for me. But during the height of the fighting, I was still, I still saw, you know, I kind of was sympathetic to the domino theory, Eisenhower's theory, although I was unhappy with some of the Republican leadership like Dulles, but I was still sympathetic to American interests, it's another one of those things, so much during my adulthood, where I saw, I see myself as being kind of apathetic. I've never been a strong political leader. I've always been in this moderate camp of trying to bring people together, which I think in one way reflects a fear of being in controversial causes on my part. It's kind of a lack of standing up on the top of the barricade. I don't do that. I'm kind of concerned about safety. But on the other hand, I get very unhappy with the stupidity and the narrowness of leadership who are very parochial in their views. And I see Vietnam as a terribly damaging experience in American history, and really, I think, has contributed to some of the rigidity and anti-human behavior see in our culture right now as a result of some of our leadership in Vietnam. I think Vietnam is highly tragic in our history.
Now, during that time period, too, I know a lot of America definitely feared about communism. Was that something on your mind where it went against the American way of life, or were you less concerned about communism as a whole?
I always, well, first, you know, I have a personal feeling about communism because my grandfather left Europe, left Poland in the late 1800s. I think at that point Russia came in and invaded Poland. The Russians would incarcerate Jews and force them to serve in the army for 25 years. So Louis Ball left Poland, one of the reasons that motivated him, in addition to lack of economic opportunities. So, and I remember at the World's Fair in 1939, my father refused to go in the Soviet exhibit, and he wouldn't even look at it. He don't look at them. They're bad people. So I always disliked Stalin and communism. And then I thought American communists made me very unhappy. I disliked them, and I thought Americans who were sympathetic to the communists were really very narrow and dogmatic. On the other hand, I really disliked McCarthy and McCarthyism, and I found that very frightening. and I was delighted to see McCarthy destroyed. I thought McCarthy was an autocrat just a rise and a continuation of the isolationism that was prevalent in the United States in the 30s. But also, I get unhappy with people on the fringes, the fascist movement, people on the extreme right, extreme left. I'm a person who lives in the middle. And I always felt that the communist menace in the United States was overdone, exploited by a lot of people for their own purposes. On the other hand, I was very unhappy with the blacklisting of the Hollywood 10, is it? And how the whole anti-communist movement was very destructive to democratic freedom. In that sense, I really felt there was a threat and a bad threat.
All right, Phil, we are going to wrap this up for at least this part of the interview. That way we can continue some more historical events on Interview 2.
You didn't ask me about my witnessing of Pearl Harbor.
Oh, wow. That we will do in Interview 2, which will take place a few minutes after this.
Okay.
But thank you.
Okay, thank you.